The Origin of the Universe. Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 to 5 and 14 to 19, describing the creation of the earth and the solar system and the universe. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. In our first lecture in this series on the Bible and science, we discovered that the Son of God, the second person of the triune Godhead, brought the entire universe into existence within one literal week of time, by purely supernatural processes, out of nothing. Our uncertainty as to the time periods that elapsed between Adam and the flood, and between the flood and Abraham, made it impossible for us to give an exact date to the creation week. But this does not mean that the universe was created millions of years ago, or even hundreds of thousands of years ago. 10 or 12,000 years at the most would seem to be a reasonable estimate of the antiquity of man, and therefore the world that God created for him, from the standpoint of biblical chronology. But it is not possible, scientifically, to allow for such a recent origin of the universe, is it? It all really depends on what one means by scientific. If science means a systematic analysis of presently observed phenomena and their processes, then science cannot contradict the biblical record of origin. For no one can determine the age of a thing unless he knows its original condition and the rate of change that has brought it to its present condition. Let's begin with two simple illustrations. If you were to walk into an abandoned house and find on the table a candle still burning, and noticed, after a period of observation, that it was burning at the rate of about 1 inch an hour, and you also discovered that at the time you entered the house, the candle was 6 inches high, how long ago was that candle lit? Well, obviously, you can't find that answer unless you know one additional factor, namely, how high was it when it started to be burned? You see, the starting point is absolutely vital, as well as the process rate, to determine the age of an event or a thing. If you looked up on the wall and saw an old clock still ticking, an 8-day wind-up clock, and you noticed that just 5 minutes after you entered the house, the clock stopped ticking, how long ago was it wound up? Well, you might guess approximately 8 days. But wonder if the owner of the house had just wound it up part way when he left. Thus, you cannot determine whether its original condition was a full wind-up or whether it was halfway unwound. The starting point is absolutely essential to determine how much time has elapsed during the process. Now, let's apply these illustrations to the age of the stars and of the moon and of the earth and of the oceans and of the human race. People ask the question, if God created all things at a comparatively recent time, how is it that some stars are hundreds of millions, in fact billions of light years away? Does this not demand that God created them billions of years ago? And the answer is no. Because a light year is a measurement of distance, not of time. And while we do have accurate means of measuring the distance of stars, not simply by parallax, but also by studying certain pulsating stars and their rate of pulsation in comparison to their intrinsic brightness and apparent brightness, and other very subtle and quite accurate methods, so that we do know that the universe is fantastically large. In fact, the scriptures emphasize the vastness of the universe, which no man can measure. Yet, can we be sure that those stars were created at a time indicated by their distance from the Earth? Let's put it this way. Did God have to wait several billion years after He created the stars for the light to get to the Earth to accomplish its God-intended purpose? Notice the statement in Genesis 1:14 and 15. Let there be lights in the firmament of heaven, and let them give light upon the earth. Their basic purpose was to shine upon the earth. And knowing the omnipotence of God as set forth in the Holy Scriptures, we may be sure that God was perfectly capable of creating not only the stars, but the starlight already reaching the earth, accomplishing God's purpose for it. In other words, God created a dynamic, functioning universe. God is not limited by time or process. Consider the moon. All of us are fascinated by the astronauts walking upon the moon and bringing back samples of moon dust and moon rocks. Very few people seem to realize, however, that the basis upon which the age of these rocks is determined is filled with all types of hidden assumptions. How do you really know how old a moon rock is? Is it soft and crumbly and rotten? If it's old, but hard and firm, if it's young? No. Certainly, you can't tell by looking at a rock how old it is. All of these things must be measured according to a uniformitarian scheme of interpretation, which decides in advance what the moon must have been like when it started, and then work from there to its present condition. But how do we know what it was like when it started? The facts are that the moon does not contain within itself the clues to its own antiquity. Some astronomers have thought that the moon was condensed from gas dust particles together with the Earth. But as we shall see, this is impossible. From the standpoint of physics and chemistry. Some think the moon was captured by the Earth from some other orbit, or that it popped out of the Earth and moved into its present orbit. But neither of these theories can possibly be maintained in the light of known laws of astrophysics, celestial mechanics. So that we do not know what the moon was like. Was it highly radioactive? Did it have a cool crust? Nobody knows. Therefore, until we have that missing factor, that missing clue of the starting point of the moon's condition, we have no basis, no criterion for determining its age. Consider the Earth itself. Geologists, of course, assume that the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. How do they know? They assume that when the earth began, it was a molten mass of highly radioactive rock and metal. But this can't be proved. The Word of God tells us that the earth was created with a cool crust, capable of supporting liquid oceans. And that God distributed throughout the crust of the earth all types of metals for man to discover and to utilize for God's glory, subduing the earth and ferreting out its hidden mysteries was one of the great challenges God gave to Adam and to his descendants. God created the earth, you see, as a dynamic, functioning entity appropriate as a home for man. And God did not have to wait 4 billion years for it to cool down, to make it a home for man. Therefore, if we do not know what the earth was like when it started, we have no way of determining how long it has taken for it to get to its present condition. Astronomers, of course, are deeply perplexed with the question, how could a molten mass of highly radioactive rock and metal have come into existence in the first place? Even if we grant, for the sake of argument, that the earth began in that condition, the more important question is, how did it get to that condition? Where did it come from? And as we shall see, no one knows the answer to that either. Consider the age of the oceans. Scientists have estimated that the oceans must be hundreds of millions of years old on the basis of assuming that it began as fresh water poured out of the crust of the earth, juvenile, volcanic water, and that through hundreds of millions of years of gradual erosional processes as rivers eroded from the continental areas, the rocks and the salts that were carried in solution, sodium and chlorine and so on, that gradually the salts accumulated in the ocean to their present amount. But how do we know that the oceans began as fresh water? The book of Genesis suggests that God created the oceans, as well as the continents, as a dynamic, mature entity, complete with its salts that were the proper environment for saltwater creatures. So we, on this basis, are forced to conclude that the oceans are very young, because if God created them as salt, and rivers have added more and more salt since their creation, they would all have become like the Dead Sea by now, if the earth were hundreds of thousands of years old. Take the human race itself. Could the human race have been on this earth hundreds of thousands of years? No. Because even if the population growth rate were one-fourth of what it has been in recorded history, there would be so many people now alive that the known universe could not contain them. Dr. Henry Morris has worked out this formula very carefully in his volume, Modern Science and Biblical Cosmology. The fact is that the rarity of human fossils and the rapid growth rate of the human race today points inevitably to a comparatively recent creation of man and a comparatively recent distribution of man since the time of the Great Flood. God created the earth mature, functioning, fully equipped. God created liquid oceans on this planet and an atmosphere composed basically of the gases as we see them today. Thus, our philosophical, religious starting point, our basic assumptions, are all important as we seek to determine the original state and the true antiquity of God's creation. These facts have been revealed to us by God Himself. And if we reject His Word, we find ourselves forever locked within the limitations of our finite and sinful perspective. God alone holds the key to origins. But are there any clues from the realm of science that point to a relatively recent creation of the universe? Yes, there are. Allow me to mention just three or four of these clues. First, in a remarkable article in the 1971 annual edition of the Creation Research Society Quarterly, Dr. Thomas G. Barnes, professor of physics at the University of Texas in El Paso, explains how the rate of decay of the Earth's magnetic field demands a recent origin of our planet in terms of thousands rather than millions or billions of years. Secondly, in the same quarterly, Professor Harold S. Slusher, an astronomer and geophysicist at the University of Texas in El Paso, points out that over 14 million tons of meteoritic dust fall into the Earth's surface from outer space every year. If the Earth were 5 billion years old, as evolutionary uniformitarian geologists demand, there should be 54 feet of such dust rich in nickel content all over our planet and the ocean floors. But the fact is, there is almost none. The same is true of the moon, where astronauts expected to sink deep in moon dust at their first landing, but found only a very thin layer on the average of about 1/4 of an inch. In the third place, Professor Slusher has pointed out that comets are an integral part of our solar system. Astronomers agreeing that whenever the solar system began, it had its complete supply of comets as well. However, comets are continually undergoing disintegration from gravitational and radiational effects of the sun and the planets as they orbit through the solar system. Therefore, all comets would have vanished by now if the solar system were more than 15 to 20,000 years old. In the fourth place, other impressive evidences include the destruction of the spiral arms of galaxies due to differential rotations, the rapid breakup of star clusters, the rapid escape of helium from the Earth's atmosphere, and the hopeless contradictions in ages of rocks determined by the so-called radiological clocks. For additional evidences, I would recommend very highly two recently published volumes by the Presbyterian and Reformed Publishing Company entitled Why Not Creation? And Scientific Studies in Special Creation, edited by Dr. Walter Lammert, a geneticist from the University of California, containing the best articles of the last decade from the standpoint of scientific creationism on the whole spectrum of problems related to the origin of the world and of the complex things that we find within it. This brings us to the vitally important question: what did God actually create in the beginning? What were the heavens and the earth like when God first brought them into existence? For the sake of human convenience, the Bible divides the heavens into three categories. We discover in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 that the Apostle Paul had a unique experience early in his ministry as an apostle. We read, "Now it is not expedient for me, doubtless, to glory. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I knew a man in Christ above 14 years ago. Whether in the body, I cannot tell, or whether out of the body, I cannot tell. God knoweth. Such a one caught up to the third heaven. And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell, God knoweth, how that he was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Of such a one will I glory, yet of myself I will not glory, but rather in my infirmities. In other words, that passage clearly states that God's heaven, beyond the universe, where His glory is manifested and adapted to the eyes and to the capacities of angelic and human creatures in that realm, we find a third heaven. Obviously, as we trace through the Bible on this, we discover that from man's viewpoint, God's heaven is the third. Outer space, the universe, is the second heaven. And the first heaven is the atmospheric realm surrounding our planet. And therefore, as we standing on the planet look upward, we look through two heavens. And beyond that, somewhere, is God's special manifestation of glory in the third heaven. Now, at the time of creation, in Genesis 1:1, the first heaven had its complete supply of atmospheric gases necessary for life. It was not methane, ammonia, and hydrogen, as evolutionists must assume for their miracle of chance origin of a speck of life in the ancient ocean. But it had its full balance of nitrogen, oxygen, and the other gases that are unique to this planet. But it was totally dark, because the second heaven of outer space was completely empty. The sun, moon, and stars had not yet been created. And the special light that God created during the first day in Genesis 1:3 was not yet in existence. It's not that the heavenly bodies were obscured by a heavy cloud blanket, for the waters had not yet been lifted up above the firmament or atmospheric expanse, an event that occurred on the second day of creation. If the sun and the stars were simply unveiled on the fourth day rather than being created, those who hold to the gap theory believe, this idea could have been more clearly expressed by the use of the verb appeared, as we find it in verse 9 of Genesis 1. Let the dry land appear. In other words, if something had been there already, but was veiled or covered, and then unveiled or uncovered, it would have appeared. It would not be described as being made. Those who hold to the gap theory do attempt to make a great distinction between created, which is from the Hebrew verb bara, and made, which is from the Hebrew verb asa. And therefore, in Genesis chapter 1, when we read in verse 16 that God made two great lights, that is, the sun and its reflector, the moon, that God did not actually create them. He simply brought them into function again in reference to the earth. He unveiled them. He began to use them. But this distinction is impossible. Notice, for instance, in verse 21 of Genesis 1, we are told that God created great whales, bara. But then in verse 25, God made the beast of the earth, asa. Surely there is no possible distinction intended here between the way God brought sea creatures into existence and the way He brought land animals into existence. These are just synonyms. And in this particular chapter, the verb made, asa, which is a broader term than bara, created, the verb made gains its meaning, its particular meaning in this context, from the basic verb created, with which the chapter begins. Likewise, when God created man, we read in verse 26, and God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And the next verse, so God created man in his own image. Obviously, a perfect example of Hebrew parallelism, in which we have a variety of verbs used to convey basically the same idea. A very useful technique, by the way, in literature, because if for some reason the meaning of one of the verbs in the synonymous parallelism is obscure, then we know what the statement means by comparing it to its parallel statement where a different synonymous verb is used. So throughout Genesis chapter 1, whatever may be true of other passages in the Bible, the verb made actually means created. It is synonymous with bara, created. Therefore, the text actually says that on the fourth day, and not until the fourth day, did God actually create the sun and the moon and the stars. And therefore, they were simply not present. They were not in existence at the beginning. And that is why the earth was shrouded in total darkness when God first created it by His Word.